Good morning, everybody. Today is Thursday, May 18th, 2017. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Thursday, everyone. It is a beautiful 75 degrees and overcast, so it is not too picky here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show DARPA and the Brain Invaders of the 21st Century. We've spent an entire week. We started with gut bacteria and some of the interesting connections we have found with bacillus bacteria, flagellated bacteria that can travel around your body, and some of this research that has been going on between DARPA, the Weiss Institute, tying it back to things that we already know that the military has been experimenting with. They're doing experiments right now on veterans and Lactobacillus reuteri, showing how they can control emotions and help fix PTSD. We kind of also took a look at some of this new ElectRx medicine and the stimulation of the vagus nerve of course being the direct connect from the gut to the brain called the enteric nervous system, that they not only are able to influence with gut bacteria, but also with electrical stimulation to this nerve, whether it be up next to the ear or even utilizing some sort of transcranial stimulation, that they can influence the chemicals that are produced in the brain and control emotions. Potentially, in the future, even soldiers, of course, this is all being done in the name of the war machine, but they're rolling this out into this 21st century medicine initiative as well. But remember, always on the back end, there is the military-industrial complex, and that's kind of where we ended the show yesterday. We brought this back around to some of these, the multitude of brain implant and brain connection projects to connect our brains directly to the machine. We even found out Facebook, with good old Regina Duggan from DARPA, in their secretive Building 8, is now working on tapping into brainwaves to be able to type on the computer. And of course, Facebook is a perfect vehicle for this because it will reach worldwide. We ended with a PDF that was from a conference in 2014 titled From PsyOps to Neural War, What Are the Dangers? We started looking at some of these new directed energy weapons as well as these frequency weapons and the interest that the military has had in neuroscience, some of the influences that they can have on the human body and the human brain. We found an RFP that just came out recently from DARPA. They're looking for someone to create a cheap and portable and easy to use EEG to get into every classroom and home. I mean, connect the dots, people. We're at a point here where just because we can't see it, hear it, taste it, smell it, doesn't mean it doesn't exist. We've established that, I think, pretty well. We've also established how there is a new war going on, and it literally is for our minds. Well, we are very lucky today because I intentionally ended the show on that note yesterday, so we could have a very special guest join us today, Mr. Jeff Wepperson from On the Brink Radio. Just finished episode 200 of the show. Jeff has been with us since just about the very beginning of UCY. Jeff is coming to us live from down under today, and I hope you're there, Jeff.
Right, mate. How the heck are you, Jules?
Good evening. What time is it there?
It is now 12:06 a.m. tomorrow. I'm in your future.
You're in my future, yes. It is Friday there. It is 10:07 a.m. Eastern Time here, live doing the show. So, wow, that's great. And look, there's not even any echo like there used to be in the old days.
Yes, everything seems to be working very well so far.
Knock on wood. So I listened to your interview that we had uploaded. Catch it if you didn't get to hear it on YouTube, UCY TV channel. Jeff had an interview 2 weeks ago with Dr. Terry Lilly. Am I correct?
Absolutely. I call him Mr. Limpet in the honor of the
Mr.
fact.
Limpet.
But did you ever see that Walt Disney movie from the 1960s?
I did.
Don Knotts, he fell in and he turned into a fish. And he had this sound that he made. He was like, ooh, it was his own underwater sort of sonar blast that he could destroy submarines and stuff. But Terry Lilly spends probably a third of his waking life underwater.
And where is he?
Right now, he's probably en route. He's been in the Bahamas for the past week or two. He's probably on his way back home, or he might be back in Kauai now. That's where he's based out of. Kauai. Yes.
Now, in that interview, he had talked about a lot of his research that he had been doing since, I believe, 2006, where he was able to get very high-definition photographs of the coral reefs off of Kauai. And he has been able to document from very early on the slow death of those coral reefs. Correct?
Absolutely. This is a very, very huge, major story that's sort of gradually breaking like a giant tidal wave. But before, may I talk for just a couple of minutes about that? Before that, I'd like to unveil my own secret frequency weapon here just for a minute. Are you ready?
Sure.
That is my Native American aromatic cedar flute in the key of F sharp, made by Odell Borg of High Spirits Flutes. That is the ultimate frequency weapon.
Now, isn't that what you use in your intro for your show?
Absolutely.
Usually you play that at the beginning.
Yes, along with some whale sounds. But back to Terry Lilly, he is such a fantastic person. I really look forward to the day that I get to meet him in person. We're working on getting him down under right now. Right now, I'm on Magnetic Island, which is just off of the center of the Great Barrier Reef, where what we're trying to do now is to do the same sort of documentation of the reef destruction here that Terry has documented so comprehensively and effectively there off of Kauai. The gist of the whole story is, we've covered this numerous times in the 5 interviews I've done with him and his colleague Stuart Simonson, who's a chemical engineer that lives in Atlanta, mapping out the electromagnetic and microwave effects of military industrial activity and presence specifically on the coral reefs of Kauai. Terry's, with all his underwater diving and stuff, he's documented the health of the corals. And you have to understand, because there's a major, well, it's been going on for a long time. Hawaii's always been a very major American military outpost, you know, back in the days of Pearl Harbor and stuff like that. But now with the Pacific pivot and the thing with China and all that stuff, Kauai is turning into one of the most major U.S. military places in the whole Pacific Ocean. There's a move underway there now to actually put offensive nuclear missiles there.
And no way.
Yeah, absolutely. They were even 2 or 3 weeks ago, they were having nuclear war attack drills on TV, getting people to, like, remember, I don't know if you remember, when I was a kid, we used to have nuclear war drills where we'd have to turn your desk on its side and get down behind it so the exploding glass wouldn't blind you. They were actually doing that kind of stuff. And he said they were...
They made us go into the hall and lean our faces against the brick and cover our eyes.
Yes, exactly. This is just
to
ride out the blast. But this is very interesting. Another footnote is that basically this whole Korean thing has basically been sponsored by Lockheed in order to sell their new...
We found out that Jason scientists no longer exist in giving good advice to the military. You have all of these plants for military industrial complex companies that are the actual advisors that are telling the DOD what new weapons to buy.
Absolutely.
And they are constructing the whole war machine.
Absolutely. In this case, it's an organization called CSIS. I forget exactly what it stands for, but it's basically funded by Lockheed, but it's the organization advising the U.S. administration on the necessity of placing these THAAD missile systems. I forget exactly what that stands for, but they want to put them all over South Korea, and the South Korean people don't want it there, because if they put that shit there, they're really going to become a target. But I mean, the threat from North Korea is like a matchstick compared to like one U.S. aircraft carrier. But so anyway, back to Terry Lilly. What he's documented is he documented the relatively pristine health of the coral reefs all around Kauai. And in 2012, when they started really amping up this facility there, it's called the Pacific Missile Range Facility. They have a massive microwave installation on the north shore of Kauai with at least 26 different antenna complexes and arrays. And within months of...
Microwaves, huh?
Yes.
We actually dug a lot into microwaves and some of the technology. I mean, this goes way back to even the beginning of the 20th century with Bell Labs.
Absolutely. Well, the Russians. The Russians were far ahead with microwaves, which is
in the 50s.
Yeah. Well, no, but in the 30s.
Really?
Absolutely. But let me just finish on Terry. He started documenting how within a few months of when they brought this new facility online and all these giant microwave antennas broadcasting it basically in every direction on the North Shore, he noticed that the corals started to die. And they didn't die in a way that's associated with bleaching. They actually die in a different way. They look different. They turn brown, and then they dissolve into mush. And he started documenting all this so heavily over the past few years, and he's a really unique person, because he's able to communicate with the head, the admiral or the captain that's the head of this facility. And like I was saying, his brother is the CEO of this kind of a quasi secret corporation. I've got the name of it written down somewhere, but you can't find anything about it. But they manufacture secret electronic parts for the naval research and DARPA and all this stuff. And he doesn't like his brother, but their family's very well connected with the sort of upper echelon. But Terry's very much the black sheep. But so he was able to. What he pulled off was he successfully was able to communicate with the Navy and demonstrate what they've done. And what he succeeded in doing was getting them to move a lot of this activity far offshore. Not that it's really any better. It's really like NIMBY, not in my backyard, that kind of thing. But at least, but since they've moved all this microwave stuff far offshore, the corals have started coming back, regenerating very, very, very beautifully and powerfully. This is just in the past few months, and so he's
now that they've moved all.
Yes, because once the debilitating influence was removed, they've been able to spring back. They weren't permanently killed. This is very much of a metaphor for what Mother Earth might be able to do if the whole military-industrial civilization, which is the source of her main ailment, was removed. Because, you know, and that's another whole tack that we can talk about later. But yes, he's a very amazing person, and we're trying to get him down here because he reckons the exact same thing is going on with the Great Barrier Reef, because down under, New Zealand and Australia are integral parts of the U.S. military worldwide network, very compliant. Especially even New Zealand in the past couple of years with these U.S. warships coming down there and stuff. They're both sort of like proving grounds for all this new technology and war games and stuff. But he reckons that as weak as they might still be, there are still some environmental regulations active in America that don't give Uncle Sam total carte blanche to do whatever he wants. But down here, there's no environmental regulations at all. There's nothing like that. And when you're talking undersea warfare, it's basically invisible to everybody. So he reckons that because of there's massive submarine bases and naval bases and stuff 8 kilometers from where I am right now in Townsville, and also a major submarine base up at Cairns about 4 hours to the north, and this shoots right out through the Great Barrier Reef. So he reckons he wants to get down here and do extensive underwater photography of the corals to see to verify his suspicion that what's killing them is the same thing that's destroyed the ones in Kauai.
Wow. So, now I heard him mention something about National Geographic taking an interest in his work.
Yes, they made a series of films called Reef Madness. It's kind of the titles that take up on Reefer Madness, but it documents this whole process. Actually, he made it two or three years ago, and it was scheduled to be broadcast on National Geographic, but when Rupert Murdoch took it over, he shit-canned it all. But now they're sort of taking it they're kind of redoing it in a slightly different way, and I think it's going to get shown. But he's also working on a separate film called, tentatively entitled, Before and After the Navy, that kind of specifically looks at, not as a series, but in one film, exactly what he's talking about. But see, but this is huge. It's not only huge because of what it's demonstrating, it's also showing what's not causing these die-offs, and it's not, forgive me for saying these words, it's two C words in a row, climate change. It's not climate change, because he specifically documents that how on the other side of the island, in the ocean with the same temperature, in the ocean with the same salinity, the same levels of everything, those corals were fine, but on the side with all the microwaves, they're the ones that were dissolving. And he's also documented a similar thing off of an island in the Philippines last year called Opo Island, where up in there, the Philippines has successfully kept any military activity out of their... this island has successfully kept military activity out of their waters. Not the Philippines as a whole, because the Philippines as a whole is a giant American military installation.
Now, you brought up a bunch of good points. I mean, one of the things we have to worry about, too, is if microwave radiation is doing this to another living organism, then what is it doing to us? Because we are not only bathed in microwave radiation from our microwaves, but people don't typically realize that your cell phones, as well as your inner 2.11 wireless routers, also are in the microwave frequency range. And, you know, now as they're turning on this 5G and millimeter wave for this internet in the sky, I heard you guys mention that. That has a lot to do with what they are doing in the atmosphere, the plasma bombing the sky.
Absolutely. The microwave, this new shift over the past 10 or 20 years, Dr. Nick Begich, who is probably singularly responsible for our advanced knowledge of HAARP. He's the son of a famous senator who was assassinated by a plane crash in Alaska. Because, just a really quick footnote on him, Nick Begich's dad was on a flight with Senator Hale Boggs of Louisiana to fly to Washington, and their plane disappeared over the Yukon and was never found. They think it was shot down by a missile, but guess what? Hale Boggs was the only dissenting member of the Warren Commission. You know what that is? It means he's the only one that didn't buy the story of Lee Harvey Oswald shooting Kennedy. So this must have been back in the 60s. But Dr. Begich is so responsible for our advanced knowledge of HAARP. But yeah, microwaves. He talks about how all this stuff in his book, Angels Don't Play This HAARP, which I highly recommend. But he said that the transition into the new sort of electric military, with focusing on microwaves, which is ultimately an offshoot of a lot of the work of Nikola Tesla, he said that this is a threshold that we've crossed that's just as great as the splitting of the atom.
Well, I would totally believe it, too, because they're cracking all of the secrets of biology is what is behind all of this. And one of the things I wanted to run by you was the fact that I ran across communications with submarines as being in the VLF and the ELF frequency range.
Yes.
And the reason for that is because you have to reach these submarines deep into the water, but it also happens to be the same frequency range that our brains operate on.
Yes.
Have you been seeing any type of, I know you've done lots and lots of studies on the effects of some of these communication techniques and sonar and that on cetaceans, which I was pointing out on the show yesterday at the end of the show, are mammals, just like us. They just live underwater. Have you looked at any of the influence that some of this may have on aquatic organisms?
Absolutely. That's very much of an ongoing thing that I'm working on sort of continuously. Let me just make two footnotes to things that you said. You just mentioned two very important areas that where you the point was that the general public is basically scientifically ignorant about A, what microwaves are, and B, that whales and dolphins are air-breathing mammals like us. And so, you know, we're touching on a major issue with the whole humanity as a whole, because in the world of today, we're, and this is kind of a paraphrase of Carl Sagan, the astronomer, that we're living in a world where everybody in the Western world is influenced every hour of the day by various forms of advanced science and technology, but ironically and paradoxically, the average person has no idea of what it is that makes these technologies work. Or that even, I mean, I think most people would probably know that whales and dolphins are mammals, but they go like, well, they're very intelligent animals. They're beautiful creatures. And my whole approach with them is that, no, I mean, that puts them beneath us. They're, as far as I'm concerned, they're light years beyond us in terms of their evolution, their perfect adaptation to living on this planet. They used to live on the land, and they went back to the ocean, possibly even giving up hands. Possibly. They went back to the ocean, and I think because it's a much safer and more stable environment to live. And, you know, but I mean, this is another whole show to talk about who the whales and dolphins are. But yes, it's very difficult. We have to assume, you know, like talking about the effects of microwaves, it's very similar to the effects of, in some ways, maybe not in the effects themselves, but in the sense of the way that the effects might be studied with radionuclides, you know, radiation coming from fission reactions like has come out of Fukushima and all the atmospheric tests and stuff like that, that anybody that studies this stuff will tell you that people are going to be affected differently. There's going to be people that are very sensitive to these things, microwaves, radiation, whatever, tending to be the very old, the very young, developing fetuses. There's going to be people that are damaged and made ill by it very easily. And at the other end of the spectrum, there's going to be probably a smaller group of people that are going to show little or no effects at all, almost like it's not having an effect on them. But in the middle is going to be the statistical majority of people that do show significant effects. So I think, you know, in terms of the ongoing studies of the survivors of Hiroshima, for example, they're probably mapping out this from generation to generation, you know, how different people and families have been affected. And, you know, it's quite diabolical how humanity is looked on just as laboratory rats by this whole mentality. You know,
we sure are.
The people that would...
More now, I think, than ever before.
Absolutely.
This march towards, you know, this biology evolution that we are self-directing, apparently.
Well...
To take us to this transhumanist,
well,
self-directed, genetically modified new breed of human.
It calls to mind the something that my dad told me once. I was shocked to learn. I love my mom and dad so much, but one day I was talking with my dad in the mid-90s. He had been in the Army for a few years, and he was a low-level intelligence guy, and he was very intelligent as a person, and I think that, anyway, we were talking one day, and we somehow got on the topic of Nazi Germany, and he came out saying that he thought Hitler had the right idea. And I was shocked. My mouth dropped open, because this was the guy that used to preach in church about loving one another, you know, and he was responsible for inspiring me to self-educate myself. And I mean, one of the best parent that somebody could have. And here he was saying that he thought Hitler had the right idea, but he went about it the wrong way. And I went like, well, what was the right idea? And he goes, like, to create a master race. So in my mind, he had been sort of somehow brainwashed with this idea when he was in the army that the main goal we should strive for is to create a master race for what? For some unknown purpose. You know, but that looks exactly like what the whole transhumanism thing actually is. It's that...
What's the perfected human? That's what they're looking for.
But it's so psychotic and bullshit because, I mean, we're already perfect except for all the stuff we've done to fuck ourselves up.
Well, it's our differences that make us who we are. And I just read an interesting study about the brain the other day. They now have found that first of all, that our neural patterns are as individualistic as fingerprints. That was a while ago, and they had discovered that they could use it for identification purposes.
Yes.
So I think this is kind of what's behind this new RFP from DARPA with these EEGs. $30 EEGs to get one in every pot, mind you. But the other thing that they just discovered, I saw another study maybe a week or two ago, that they found that genetic defects in our neurons that give us the ability to do things better maybe than other people, like connect the dots or like seeing patterns and things. They think that that's actually a genetic defect that causes that. So, of course, if they get rid of all the defects, quote-unquote defects, in the general population, those special defects, quote-unquote defects, that they find can be used for the new and improved human.
Absolutely. They're probably looking at how to weaponize every possible dimension of knowledge that can be ascertained. Remember the thing when we were in school, they taught us that we only use 10% of our brain, and you've got like that kind of, we only use 10% of our brain, and then there's the whole concept of what used to be called junk DNA. It's like they couldn't find any sort of thing that it was actually doing. But I think DNA and RNA, like the whole concept of frequency, like all the stuff, they aren't reality. They're a concept that our brains and minds have come up with. It's a model or a simulation of an aspect of reality. You know, so a lot of this is actually happening in the domain of manipulating symbols and maps and simulations that can then have an effect on the real world. But I don't know, I sort of forgot what I was saying there. But I think that anything that affects us is going to affect the whales and dolphins in the same way. But one of the big differences is, A, that they've been here for 30 million years. They've been highly evolved, highly conscious, creative, intelligent mammals, much more perfectly adapted to their environment than us. They've been there for 30 million years, and we don't even know what we looked like a million years ago, or even 500,000. So we're a new mutation, and plus they live in the ocean, and sea water, and especially seawater, has vastly different properties than living in air, like the conductivity of electrical fields, microwaves, and water. That's been a very big issue, similar to the transmission of light into a telescope through the atmosphere. A big problem has always been the turbulence in the atmosphere when you get to extremely high levels of magnification. You know, it looks like everything's moving, and I think they've had to overcome the same kind of technical problem with shooting a microwave beam under the water. But, you know, with all the time and money and university research departments and think tanks and stuff that work on all this stuff, they eventually conquer the technological issues, just like that they're gradually trying to do with their vision of what they want to do with our brains. And so, you know, I'll just throw this out. Another thing that I'm seriously entertaining, and I've mentioned this for a few years to some researchers, is that, you know, how what we call the Alzheimer's syndrome, where people start getting dementia and they think it's linked with heavy metal poisoning, aluminium, or as they say in America, aluminum and other metals and stuff. I was wondering if the whales and dolphins might be, some of them, the more susceptible ones, might be getting a sort of a form of cetacean Alzheimer's Dementia from all the extraordinary amount of heavy metals in the ocean that are found in their bodies sometimes when tests are done. You know,
I just saw recently a whale that they were testing that washed up somewhere, and it was probably the most polluted animal, water, marine animal that they had ever seen.
Absolutely. It was like a toxic waste that you couldn't even touch. Yeah. And how to think that there's fellow beings out there swimming around with that much stuff in their body.
And in humans, our brains are loaded with magnetite. Did you see that? Now they're blaming it on the quote-unquote pollution. They're nanoparticles of magnetite.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what that is.
Little metallic balls all in our brains. And they use them. I saw it was a new therapy they were looking at for fMRIs. Which, you know, we found we already have them in our brains conveniently because of us breathing in pollution, they say.
Very convenient.
Yeah. But they can also heat up tissue that way remotely using frequencies.
Very interesting. But just a footnote on that thought, Dr. John Wise at the Wise Laboratory, he's a genetic toxicologist now in Louisville, Kentucky. He was working with Ocean Alliance, which is headed by my friend Ian Kerr and founded by Dr. Roger Payne.
What was that again? I didn't catch that.
Dr. Roger Payne and Ian Kerr founded an organization called Ocean Alliance. Yes,
okay.
and they did a five-year survey of global ocean toxicity with their research vessel. And Dr. Wise is the environmental toxicologist that analyzed all of their data. And I asked him about this cetacean Alzheimer's thing, and he said, well, this was several years ago. In fact, I'm trying to get in touch with him to do an interview now. He said that he reckoned that the cellular structure of whales and dolphins was different from ours in such a way that it had more of a barrier to prevent that kind of stuff from getting into their sort of inner workings, like especially their brain. And I thought that was very interesting. It's like they've evolved to have systems in their body that we don't even have, in the same way that they have a fourth lobe of their brain, the parietal lobe, that no other mammal has.
Now, speaking of them having different systems than us, have you looked any into the sequencing of the genome of the jellyfish? Have you paid attention to any of that?
No, but it's probably going to be for culinary purposes.
Why so, you eat jellyfish?
But they can make a new peanut butter and jellyfish sandwich. No, I haven't read about
they
that.
They are using some of their bioluminescent genes and things.
Very interesting. Yeah, is there anything whose genome they're not sequencing?
No, they're sequencing them all, but they were saying that jellyfish is so different from anything else they've ever seen on Earth that they could almost say that it was alien.
Well,
I believe it.
Yes, and there was another article talking about octopuses, the cephalopods, saying this.
I almost think they have close to a human-sized brain, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, check this out.
Their eyes look human, too.
Check this out. A couple of years ago, I was living on the coast of central New South Wales in a place called Wamberal Lagoon, and every day I'd go out to the ocean and there was this little rock pool by the ocean, and it was just the right size for me to lay down in about half a meter deep of water, and I would usually go and lay there for a few minutes. And one day I was laying there, my hands were out by my side, and I just sort of, my finger kind of moved it, and my finger touched something really long and hard and straight. It felt like a stick, but then it moved. And I'm like, what? And I looked over there, and it was an octopus underneath this little rock ledge. It was about, its head was about 20 or 30, 40 centimeters in diameter. And I saw it pull its little tentacle back. But it's the first time I ever touched an octopus. But I was surprised at how hard and long and hard the tip of its tentacle was. So it went back under there and disappeared. But it struck me as quite cool. So then, a few months later, I was in that exact same rock pool, laying in exactly the same position, and I'd totally forgotten about the wee octopus. And I was laying there, my hand was in the same spot, and believe it or not, I felt something reach out and touch me. this time it touched me instead of me touching it, and it was the octopus in the same exact spot. And it reached out and touched me. And maybe I think it recognized me, because maybe they, not even so much visually, but maybe the chemical, you know, the taste of my, of one that touched my skin or something like that. But it was like it was going, "Hi, man, I'm still here." And this time it came out and looked at me. And I stood up. I was in water about up to my knee, and it came out and it kind of went around my legs, and it came up to the surface. And I actually stood up because I wasn't sure that if an octopus can stick its tentacles up out of the water or not, you know, like, and I didn't want it to, I wasn't afraid of it, but I didn't want it to wrap its tentacles around my head or something. And but we looked at each other, but
by the ankles and pull you in.
But it wasn't scared. And it looked at me, and it hung out very, you know, for a few minutes, and then it kind of went over under the other ledge, and it sat there, but not out of sight. And I went down and looked at it, and I didn't try to touch it, but I stuck my finger over there just towards it, and it just kind of pulled back a little bit, but it didn't run away. But it was so cool, but I guarantee you, it remembered me from before.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I've never met an octopus. Maybe a jellyfish dead once in Florida.
Yes, but my friend Glenn Edney, who's another, he's kind of like the Jacques Cousteau of New Zealand. He does a lot of underwater diving and photography, and he used to work and do a lot of stuff with whales in Tonga. I've interviewed him a few times on the show too. But his basic thing that he shared in our first interview was that when you get down under the water, everything seems much more intimately connected with each other. Like every different life form, it's like part of a family, and you can just see it. You see the connectedness even more than life forms on land.
Absolutely. Now, did you see that story I dropped you here today from RT about the future of the Navy?
I did. I just scanned through that. I've been onto a lot of that stuff, especially when, remember back in November when I was in New Zealand, there was this big hullabaloo about the fact that they were going to let this American destroyer class vessel come to New Zealand for the first. They'd been banned from coming there since the 1980s under the Longhi administration because of New Zealand's no nuclear policy. And this,
well, I think it was even before the 80s, because when I was a kid, I remember hearing about that. New Zealand was always nuke-free.
Yes. Well, anyway, but in November, all these warships came. They were going to have these war games in Auckland Harbor with over 30 warships from many different countries. And it was to celebrate the 75th anniversary of the founding of New Zealand's Navy. And there was part of this, kind of one of these multi-letter acronyms of some kind of Southeast Asia military organization whose name I can't remember. But anyway, but they said that the express purpose of this war game was to look at how to combat non-traditional security threats, which would mean, quote-unquote, terrorists, which is really, we know what that is. That's terrorists is the people that go around blowing stuff up with their armies and their, you know, that's the real meaning of terrorism. And so right on the very day that this was scheduled to begin, there was a giant 7.8 earthquake down in Kaikoura, just north of Christchurch. And I documented this heavily because it was such an exact parallel, with the Christchurch quake. You know, when all the major U.S. disaster management people were there. It was just, you know, and it seemed like that this quake was totally artificially created too.
I've been to Kaikoura.
Well, it'll look
Church.
it'll look very different the next time you go.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah, that was in the 70s, so it was a long time ago.
You got to get back down there.
I mean, when you take a look at, I dropped you a document that I ran across back a few months ago that showed up in a Google search engine, and when I clicked on it, it told me that I didn't have access because I wasn't authorized. So someone had posted it and then had put a password protect on it. So I went into Google Cache and I was able to pull it up, and it goes through like recent events that have been going on in the back end discussing funding and that for HAARP.
Yes.
I don't know if you had a chance to look at that. This document was posted on January 29th, 2017. I tried to pull it up on March 13th, 2017, and it was password protected.
Yes.
But it had the last version cached in Google Cache. And it had really discussed a lot about some of the different things that they are experimenting with, including the atmosphere. The one guy, the one scientist had said, like, this is the first time ever we can totally use our atmosphere itself as the petri dish or something of that nature.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I did read that. That was very, very interesting. And also, it directly ties in with the article that you just sent me just now about this admiral's dream of the new Navy.
Mm-hmm.
What it would be like.
I could also send you something about the Air Force plasma bombing the sky.
Ah, please do.
This whole document talks about the plasma.
Yes, please do. That's the up and coming thing. This admiral, another part of his dream would be an ocean entirely free of whales and dolphins, because then there won't be any large objects to cast sonar bogeys. But what I was going to say is that yes, this is an example of that. The new threshold that Dr. Begich talked about, that's as great as the splitting of the atom, the whole atomic age in the 1940s. We've crossed that new threshold in the 1990s with microwaves. And how it's all, you know, like, you've probably talked about Nikola Tesla on your show a lot. A lot of this stuff is actually based on patents that he came out with, and you know, like in the 1910s. Almost, you know, 100 years
ago. That's another show. I don't think I've ever covered Tesla on this show.
Well, a lot of people go like, oh, yes, he was this, he loved humanity and he wanted everybody to have free electricity and stuff like that. And I go like, you know, if you look at it, because of his work, we've been able to create the most damaging technologies that exist. Because ultimately, without... I mean, he didn't invent electricity, and there was a toss-up between him and Edison about whether they were going to use alternating current, which he invented. He first generated it in Ames, Colorado, or direct current that Edison wanted to use. They had a big row over that, but without electricity as the abundant energy supply that we have now, even computers wouldn't be possible, and computers are what makes possible the next level of all these technologies. But you know, I think a really important thing to consider about HAARP, A, is that as far as Terry Lilly reckons, well, we do know that they say that they handed the control of HAARP over to the University of Alaska over the past couple of years. But
yeah, guess what I discovered when I looked into who that president of the University of Alaska was. I just found this probably 2-3 weeks ago.
A former Navy guy.
She used to work for DARPA.
the old revolving door.
Yeah, yep.
Absolutely.
No tentacle, right in there.
Yeah.
But you know, the document too that I had up on Drive actually said that it was this conglomeration between like all of them. It's Department of Defense, funding by DARPA, the Air Force Research Laboratory, and they're the ones that were plasma bombing the sky.
Probably
and the Office of Naval Research.
It's probably coincidentally called the Phillips Laboratory. That's the Air Force Lab and Office of Naval Research. But I think the important thing to note about HAARP is that, like, we use HAARP as the sort of generic name for these technologies as a whole, but there's probably many, many dozens of these transmitters located all around the planet, primarily at polar latitudes in both the northern and southern hemisphere, because of the ability to have access to where the magnetic fields and the ionosphere comes down closer to the Earth. But it's important to note that these technologies are pretty much all integrally connected with each other, and that they're all being operated by, well, you can call it the New World Order, but it's like, you know, another thing that Terry's made clear is that there really are no enemies. The enemies exist in media, but in the real world, even the navies of Russia and China and the Soviet Union, well, I mean, Russia and Soviet Union used to be the same thing, but all these different countries that are supposedly the arch enemies of each other, if you look at their boats, they've all got the exact same technology from companies like Raytheon and Lockheed and stuff, these corporations outfit everybody. So they're the,
Yes, and you know, I brought that up the other day because we don't tend to realize, like, the Raytheons, McDonnell Douglas, the
Lockheed
Boston Dynamics. These are, and now the Googles, the Facebooks, the Microsofts are being all pulled into this fold from the digital perspective. These are corporations. These are not even like shadow government agencies. These are corporations that are selling things and monopolizing the technologies that aren't under the guise of any public oversight at all.
No. If they were bound to any law, it would be the law requiring that their primary goal was to make as much money as possible for the people that own stock in their company.
Right, which happens to be our lawmakers.
Yes. But so anyway, we're mapping out sort of how the world really is. Well, not the world, but the delusional human world that I'm finding myself increasingly distanced from as often as possible because, you know, all this stuff, our species is waging war in every possible way against every life form on Mother Earth and including Mother Earth herself. And we elevate ourselves on top of this pyramid of intelligence, and we glorify our destruction. And to me, humanity as a whole is completely off its rocker. The rocker's broken.
It's gone off the rails officially.
Absolutely, and it's just like, there was this series that came out probably 10 or 12 years ago. It was called The Corporation. And I never really watched it, but the part I liked was in the very beginning. It was interviewing this former CEO of a giant carpet company or something like that. And it's like, I don't know whether he took some acid or started meditating or something, but something woke him up. And he started going, holy fuck, what am I doing? My grandchildren are going to hate me because I'm helping to destroy the world. And he used the metaphor that human civilization was, it thought it was flying, but it was actually in a free fall. And it just hadn't hit the ground yet.
And I would say, I mean, that's kind of what's happening right now. When you start adding in all of these now mad science technologies beyond even the radio frequency spectrum and energy weapons and mind control, but you start looking at CRISPR, and they announced Clapper went out in front of the and its Senate Armed Services Committee and talked about CRISPR now being considered a WMD. And as they're sequencing the genomes of every living organism on this planet, the DARPA lady at one point, in regards to terraforming Mars, had said that, don't worry about it. You know, before we go to Mars and quote-unquote terraform it, we're going to use some of these technologies to try and clean up some of the damage we've done on this planet. And our hope is to be able to push a button and create life for our own uses.
Well, let me share this with you. I've been doing a lot of research into comets and asteroids and celestial bodies like that that have impacted the Earth, and they've really been looming large on my radar in the past few years. And I was reading a book by this guy named Duncan Steele, who used to be a very, very well-known comet researcher. And when you look at his website now, he's saying that one of the main things he's working on is writing a book advocating that one of the main things humanity should do is to seed every planetesimal body that we can access, you know, asteroids, comets, planets, anywhere that we can get to or can get a probe to, we should be seeding these bodies with genetically engineered life forms. And I'm like, dude, I hope this is a joke, because if it's not, you're one of the biggest assholes I've ever read anything by. And how much is Monsanto paying you to do this?
But think about this from the flip side. Who's to say that isn't where we came from?
Well, who knows?
You know, some species in the universe somewhere that reached this point.
Well,
and then we're just a genetic experiment that was seeded on this planet.
Well, that's the. Remember a guy named Zechariah Sitchin?
I was so sad when he died, and I know people have said he's full of crap. But if you've read all his books, and I read quite a number of his books, but I have most of them here, he had some really interesting points and some really interesting translations.
Well,
I mean, there were only like 7 people in the world that can translate those tablets.
Well,
where are the other translations?
Exactly.
So
well, to me, it was like I never bought into all that stuff. His idea of the Anunnaki, there were the beings that came from this. I said it. That's the first time I said this planet called Nibiru, or Planet X, that had a very elliptical orbit, and it came close to the Earth every couple hundred thousand years, and that the last time they were around, the Anunnaki came, and they genetically engineered our ancestors so that we could be slaves to mine the gold that they wanted. And that,
right. And I'll tell you what, Jeff, I started thinking about history, and I thought, you know, if you remember the Egyptians, they had their slave class, and everything was encrusted in gold, and the pharaohs had, well, they found some weird skeletons with the weird elongated heads and stuff, and they always claimed to be gods. And I was like, huh, it's pretty interesting, because they were the civilization that came shortly after
Atlantis.
The Sumerians.
Atlantis.
Well, and potentially Atlantis.
Well, that's another whole thing to talk about. But look, can I share something with you that's sort of a different tack, but it relates to the whole idea of frequency, which was one of the main concepts that we've been talking about. Frequency,
yes.
What it really is it's the regularity of something that happens with respect, or the amount of times that something happens with respect to a given period of time. Like the frequency of a sound is how many vibrations it makes per second, which we call hertz or something like that. And I wanted to mention one of the most important frequencies that we're a part of is called the Schumann resonance. And it's basically around 7.83 hertz, which is right in the range of the alpha frequency of our brain. And so this varies a lot, but I think that this is a normal... Tesla knew a lot about this. I mean, I think he knew a lot of really esoteric stuff, but I think that we're all kind of entrained with the Schumann resonance all the time, which is kind of like the heartbeat of Mother Earth, you might call it. But I wanted to also bring up, there was a theoretical physicist who was a student of Einstein. His name was David Bohm, B-O-H-M. And he had some relatively revolutionary ideas that go beyond the quantum relativistic cosmology. And he worked with a Stanford psychologist named Carl Pribram. That's P-R-I-B-R-A-M. I actually met him once. I went over to Stanford and saw him when I was working with John Lilly's Dolphin Group. But Pribram and Bohm's basic idea is that the brain works holographically and transduces a domain of frequency to generate the explicated physical reality that we experience. But Bohm's name for this frequency domain, he calls it the implicate holo movement, H-O-L-O movement. And I think this is a really interesting idea, because in a way it parallels, if you remember, Carlos Castaneda, the Don Juan's idea of two dimensions of reality, the tonal and the nagual, very much like the infolded and unfolded or implicate and explicate orders of the Bohm's holo movement. So the whole idea of frequency is very, very, very important, not just from a weapons technology point of view, but also from the idea of reality as a whole. And ultimately, I think that the highest expression of frequency that humans and whales and dolphins have anything to do with, I call it music. I think the whales and dolphins are probably the ultimate musicians, but we don't have the ability to hear what they really do, because even when we hear their songs, they're making sounds in a bandwidth of 250,000 hertz, where we can't even hear a tenth of that. You know, and this is just audio vibration, but we're getting into the topic. We've touched on topics for several other shows to have and talk about here. I should probably shut up now.
Well, I'll tell you, there's probably weeks worth of shows. We took, I think, 2 weeks on frequencies the last time I hit them. And, you know, the thing that gets me, too, when you start thinking about, like, you were talking about the each note and the vibrations. You know, when you take a look at things such as cymatics, where you could just do the sand on top of a taut piece of
glass,
you know,
or metal,
even skin or whatever, and
yes,
you put the vibration, each note has its own shape. Looking back to some of the primeval you know, sand sculptures in that of the ancient Tibetans, you know, and how interestingly they are organic structures. And, you know, there really is like a full connection. I believe there's a harmony, of course, between all of life. I think we are in major discord right now.
Absolutely.
A lot of these energy weapons and technologies are part of what is disrupting all of that.
We're creating Muzak of the Spheres.
Yes, Muzak. I have the actual Music of the Spheres upstairs.
Oh, that's cool. Hey, let me share this with you. There was this well-known former New Zealand Air Force pilot whose name I forget, Bruce Cathier or something like that. And he said, I don't have a way of, but this was in his book, I don't know if it's really true, but he said he was in Tibet in the 1950s and that he personally witnessed a group of Tibetan monks levitate giant pieces of stone from a platform that they built up onto a cliff top where they were building a temple. And he said the way they did it was they had a platform and a bunch of them stood around in two groups. One group had these long horns that they blew, and it was all these were aimed at the stone. They put the stone in the middle, and that the other group of them chanted, and that they would place this big stone in the middle, and then they'd all make their sound, and it physically levitated these boulders. And he said that he watched them do it all day long. I mean, could that really be true?
I would believe it. I actually would believe it. I mean, you can take some low-frequency sounds for certain and cause things to levitate on a small scale. So why not on a larger scale? Maybe they know a secret. They are pretty ancient. They tend to know a lot more about a lot of things that we seem to have forgotten about.
Absolutely.
Well, Jeff, if you can even believe it, it has been an entire hour of conversation, and we've only just scratched the surface. So why don't you and I make it a point every few months or so, let's touch base, or if you have something that you want to get out there, and let's have a conversation now that we know when our time zones line up.
Absolutely. I'm ready whenever you are.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the discussion today. Tomorrow we are going to continue on some of this electronic weaponry and some of the newer things that are on the plate that we're going to be paying for, thank goodness. Make sure you stick around because it is Thursday. Lots of live radio today, and Hal Anthony's this week's show tonight, and some anti-media radio. So, all right, guys, make sure you have an awesome Thursday, and I will catch up with you tomorrow. Everybody, take care.
Thanks, Jules. You rock.
Thank you, Jeff.